Welcome to the show where we promote a biblically faithful and scientifically testable alternative to Darwinian evolution. And this is our July 26, 2005 broadcast. And I'm live in studio today with Drs. Hugh Ross and Dave Rockstad. Mixing it up a little bit. Hey, Dave.
Hey.
Sitting in for Fuzz today, who's hanging out with his family up in the Bay Area.
I'm a Fuzz clone. Fuzz Prime.
Minion.
Yeah, Fuzz is visiting Alcatraz right here.
Hopefully they don't throw him in there, Alcatraz. But we're back from our regional conference up in Northern California this past weekend. We had the pleasure of meeting a lot of new friends, getting to put some faces with names. That's always a fun time. And, you know, Hugh, it's just such an awesome privilege to be able to meet some of the people whose lives have been truly transformed by Reasons to Believe. Sometimes you get in the grind of coming to the office and sitting behind the computer, and you don't realize that this stuff is going out to real people whose lives have been really changed by the message.
Well, a lot of people I talked to said they were regular listeners to Creation Update, usually on the archives, not live.
Right. Yeah, I had a lot of people talk to me, too.
But the other fun thing is just hearing from people how our books brought them to faith in Christ. So that's, I heard that so frequently, and it's good to hear, and people are giving out our materials to their unsaved relatives and friends, and it's having an impact on their lives.
I just really was impressed with the church up there, Bridges Community Church up in Fremont.
The level of support that we received and encouragement was really phenomenal.
It was
very positive.
I was so thankful I got to go and meet such wonderful people, totally organized, and just seemed like the pastor was behind us, and they just really understand what we're trying to do and what we're all about. So that was very encouraging.
I thought it was neat that, you know, this wasn't always the case with the church. The pastor, I think, in the past has been very concerned about the impact of bringing up the kinds of subjects that we do and the controversy that it brings. But what was really neat was that the people who were part of that team that were helping us, you know, part of it, some of them were the chapter members or future chapter members. They were working behind the scenes and very quietly and very graciously working and explaining things to the pastor. And so that brought it to the state now after, I think, a couple of years of this kind of working behind the scenes,
well,
of bringing the pastor to that position.
There was a physicist there at the church and another gentleman who team taught a Sunday morning class that ran for 18 months. And I heard the pastors talk to them and said, well, does the Reasons to Believe team behave like you guys do? I mean, this just seems like you're really quieting these troubled waters. And they assured him that that was our style, too. And that's what opened up the door.
Right.
So it wasn't for that 18-month class.
I think that was critical. And the kind of attitudes and character that was shown by those two particular who were doing that teaching.
And their depth of knowledge, I think, was really remarkable, too. They really knew their subject well, and they knew the positions of other people that are
so they developed
different views.
Yeah, they developed a real trust relationship with that pastor.
And I know that that's a question we frequently get on the show is, how can I talk to my pastor? It just seems like, you know, such an uphill battle. But they were a great model of how it can be done carefully, slowly, persuasively, gently, and really sticking with it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So real kudos out there to all our friends up in Fremont. And it's just such a wonderful privilege to be able to go anywhere in the world and meet up with other Christians, and you just have instant fellowship with them. And I just was telling a colleague that that's, to me, one of the coolest parts of being a Christian. And that's also part of the connection we have with listeners on Creation Update. And I guess I should stop pining away about Fremont and give the rundown here, what we're doing today. Hugh is here to give us his perspectives on the scientific discoveries of the week and how they support RTB's testable creation model. We are going to begin in just a moment with a discussion about radiometric dating. That's always a topic of some degree of controversy with our young Earth friends, and as speaking of gently persuading them, this will discovery we're going to talk about involves some new insights and more confirmation into the reliability of radiometric dating techniques and new insights into the date for the creation of the universe and using radiometric dating to...
Plus, it gives us some exciting new design stuff we haven't had before.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that. And speaking of design, later in the hour, we're going to talk about another new design feature of the Earth's inner layers, another attribute that the earth needs in order to have these inner layers that we need early on in its history so that it can facilitate complex life later. And we're going to continue our series with Ken Samples about creation ex nihilo, and hopefully we'll try to wrap that up today. Plus your calls, 866-RTB-RADIO, where we will take your questions about science and the Bible. We'd
hopefully
love to hear from you.
We can talk about the fungus, too.
We've yeah.
been waiting a long time to talk
we
about
We got the fungus.
Fungus.
Fungus among us.
Fungus among us.
Yes. Get that up here in the top of my stack. 866-RTB-RADIO, or you can email us, creationupdate@reasons.org. All right, Hugh, let's talk a little bit about radiometric dating. And in particular, when we talk about radiometric dating, we don't usually talk about it in relation to dating the creation of the universe. Typically, we talk about other methods to date the universe for when it came into being, like the W map. I know we've talked about that
right,
before.
Right. Well, you're right, Krista. Radiometric dating is a method that's very accurate for dating when the Earth formed. It's now accurate to four places of the decimal. But for several decades now, radiometric dating has been the least reliable of the four or five methods we have for coming up with the creation date of the universe. And this is an astronomer from the University of Chicago. It's in the latest issue of Nature. Pardon me, not the latest issue. It's actually the June 30th issue of Nature. And he's come up with a way to make radiometric dating as accurate or more accurate than things like looking at the maps of the radiation left over from the creation event, the WMAP results, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Those are two techniques that give us a date for the age of the universe that's accurate to almost 1% precision. And then another accurate dating method is based on the burning times of the oldest stars. That gives us a date for the creation of the universe that's accurate to about 5%. But radiometric dating has only been accurate to about 20% for several decades now. And you know, it's a sticking point for lay people because these other methods for dating the creation of the universe are not as familiar to them, and they involve some complexity. And sometimes people can't understand why we can't come up with an accurate date based on radiometric dating. And also, it's from an astronomical perspective, it's icing on the cake if we can show that all these methods for dating the age of the universe are consistent. That's one of the ways of buttressing our confidence that the hot Big Bang creation model is accurate, the model that we see predicted from people like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Zechariah. So, and first of all, Nicholas Stauffis identifies where the problem is. The problem is that our models of the supernova eruptions are not detailed enough to tell us exactly what the ratio of uranium to thorium production would be when a supernova explodes. That's where all the uranium and thorium comes from. It comes from these supernova eruptions. And that's been the sticking point. In fact, as he points out...
Now, just to clarify, the stuff is made in the stars and then blasted out through supernova. So when you say it's coming from supernova, it's not made at the time of the explosion, is it? Isn't it cooked in the star?
Only supernova make uranium and thorium. The other stars don't. They're only made in supernovas. That's the only source
for
uranium and thorium.
So you're saying at the time of the explosion?
Well, what's happening with a certain class, not all supernova are very good producers of uranium and thorium, but there's one class that produces a huge amount of neutrons. And
right at the time of the eruption. Okay.
And this blast of neutrons builds up iron. You know, iron is kind of the base of nuclear fusion. You're not going to make anything heavier than iron through nuclear fusion. Mm-hmm. But what you do is you blast iron with this these neutrons, and that builds up these heavy elements.
Eventually
you get up to uranium and thorium. Mm-hmm. And Rudy takes a lot of fast-moving neutrons
to produce
uranium and thorium.
Right.
And you only get that in supernova eruptions. But the difficulty has been in trying to determine exactly how much uranium and thorium are produced by these supernova eruptions.
Mm-hmm.
And as he points out, until he came along, we did not know the ratio of uranium to thorium production in supernova any more accurately than it was somewhere between 0.4 and 0.7. And so he's come up with a technique to figure out what that ratio would have been at the time of the supernova eruptions. And what he has done is he's taken measurements of the uranium to thorium abundance in meteorites, which tells you what the uranium to thorium ratio is right now.
Mm-hmm.
But since we know with high precision what the decay rates of uranium and thorium are, we can figure out what the uranium-thorium abundance was when those meteorites first formed. And they would have formed at the same time that the Earth had formed. So it gives us the uranium-to-thorium abundance 4.566 billion years ago. And then he looks at these metal-poor stars in the halo of our galaxy, which would have formed much earlier than the solar system. And he measures the uranium-to-thorium abundance in those stars. And then he looks at the statistics and the distribution of these metal-poor halo stars to determine roughly the dates that they would have formed throughout cosmic history. And with adequate statistics, you can build kind of a timeline of what the uranium-to-thorium abundance was from the present day back to about 10 or 12 billion years. And that will give you the ratio of uranium to thorium at the time that the supernova were erupting.
Let me see if I got this straight, Hugh. So we know what the production rate is today, and we know what it is at certain key.
We don't know the production rate.
Okay.
What
or
we
the
do
decay
know,
rate?
No, what we know is the ratio of uranium to thorium in meteorites.
Okay.
He measures that.
All right.
Yeah, you measure. You find a meteorite and measure what it is.
And because meteorites were formed at the same time as our solar system, that gives us a rough date of something.
Well, okay, you get two dates out of that.
Okay.
Because you're measuring the meteorite as it is right now.
Okay.
And so there would have been a lot of decay of uranium and thorium
over
the last 4.6 billion years.
So right now we're measuring the decay.
So that gives you the right how much we have right now.
Okay, we're making a timeline. We're working
making
backwards.
A timeline,
okay.
Right. But because we know the radiometric decay rates with high precision, you can figure out what the uranium to thorium abundance was when those meteorites formed.
Okay, roughly 4.6 billion years ago or something like
4.566.
All
right. We got that nailed down to four places of the decimal. And then he goes to this suite of metal-poor halo stars in our galaxy, which would have formed much earlier than the solar system.
So now we're working even farther back in time.
Going farther back in time.
All
and
right.
What you're doing is determining uranium-thorium abundances at different points in the history of our galaxy. And that will you can use that to figure out what the uranium-to-thorium ratio must have been when the supernova exploded.
Okay. So, go ahead.
Yeah, with that, I'll just give you the numbers. You know, what he started with was somewhere between 0.4 and 0.7. Using this technique, he determines that the ratio when the supernova were exploding was 0.571 plus or minus 0.003. So we're now getting a really accurate measurement of what that... See, and that's been the greatest uncertainty in trying to date the universe with radiometric techniques. So the weakest point in the whole calculation
was
has now been
ratio,
made very strong.
Right.
Now, how do these dates correlate with these other measurements that we were talking about earlier, like from the WMAP or the Sloan Digital Sky Survey? Are we still in the same ballpark?
Well, he is. I mean, you know, this isn't a definitive work. He's simply demonstrating a technique that will enable radiometric dating to produce an accurate date for the age of the universe.
As you get more statistics.
Right. But he says, just with a little bit I've done, he says, I can come up with a date for the age of the Milky Way galaxy of 14.5 billion years, plus or minus 2.5. And that is consistent with the three other accurate methods.
Certainly within the error bars.
Yeah, like the WMAP gives you 13.7 plus or minus 0.2. The Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is a technique based on the velocities of the galaxies, gives you a date that's 13.7 plus or minus 0.2. And then you can come up with a date looking at the burning times of the oldest stars. And that gives you a date of $13.8 billion, plus or minus about $0.5 billion. And so this 14.5 mm-hmm. plus or minus 2.5 puts you in that ballpark, although in terms of the age of the universe, it would really be 14.7 based on his measurements, because mm-hmm. it takes 200 million years to go from the creation event to the formation of the Milky Way galaxy, mm-hmm. the initial formation. So 14.7 plus or minus 2.5. But as he closes his paper off, he makes the point, look, this is simply a demonstration. It wouldn't be that difficult to go out and really do a big statistical mm-hmm. study and make more accurate measurements of the spectra of these metal poor halo stars.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying it's possible that this number could even be refined more?
It's possible that this could be refined to a point where it's even more accurate than the WMAP and the Sloan Digital Sky Survey.
Now, did this scientist, Foley, did he have any tests for? I mean, I guess I'm wondering, like, how did he know that what he came up with was accurate?
Well, he's not claiming to come up with an accurate measurement. After
okay.
all, it's a demonstration measurement. It's 14.7 plus or minus 2.5. What he did come up with high accuracy was the uranium to thorium ratio
okay.
at the time supernova exploded. You know, that's about 30 times as accurate as anyone else has ever done. And with that accurate measurement, now we can make radiometric dating, instead of the poorest of the dating methods, one of the best of the dating methods.
I guess I'm just thinking what my young Earth friends might say. I'm probably asking this poorly, so maybe some of my friends out there listening can help me out by calling in. But I guess what I'm trying to get at here is I'm assuming that there's some other independent test or correlation or something that would tell the scientist that he's got the right ratios. I mean, do you somehow correlate that with some other piece of data or...
Well, maybe I'm not understanding you, Krista.
Probably not.
I mean, in my opinion, there's no doubt that he's come up with the accurate ratio of what supernova produce.
But that's not the only thing that goes into calculating the age of the universe.
Right, I understand that.
There's other
that.
Things
right.
as well.
I understand that.
That are statistical in nature.
But I guess I'm just thinking about this, because there's this big question my younger friends bring up about, well, how do we know that these rates haven't changed, for example?
Oh, well, that's a separate issue.
Well, it's a separate issue that no one in the astronomical community questions, but I'll tell you why they don't question it. Number one, we can look at distant stars and galaxies and measure the quantity of uranium and thorium and determine if indeed that would correspond with the radiometric decay rates being identical to what we measure today.
Okay.
A second argument I can give you is that there's intelligent life in the universe. For there to be intelligent life in the universe, you can't be messing with the decay rates of uranium and thorium. Though that's part of the fine-tunedness of the cosmos and its characteristics is critical for advanced life. So if the young Earth creationists were right in saying it was decaying a million times faster in the past, that would have made advanced life impossible anytime, anywhere in the universe.
Which kind of brings us to the point of the design element of this discovery, in that the solar system seems to have been formed at the just right uranium-thorium abundance moment.
Well, that's something he brings out in this paper, is that you've got these supernova producing uranium and thorium on a somewhat continual basis. But having produced it, this stuff decays. And so there's kind of a trade-off here. If you wait too long, the stuff will have decayed away. If you don't wait long enough, there won't be enough of it produced by uranium or by the supernova. And so there's a moment in cosmic history, and when you get the maximum abundance of uranium and thorium in the interstellar and intergalactic media, and that maximal point is 4.566 billion years ago. So what that shows us is that the solar system was formed at the moment of maximal uranium and thorium abundance in cosmic history. And that's a critical feature for advanced life. I mean, one of the blessings of this planet is that it's so incredibly rich in uranium and thorium. It's hyper-rich in uranium and thorium. And one of the reasons why it's hyper-rich is it was formed at that moment when uranium and thorium were maximal in their abundance in the universe. And the reason why you want uranium and thorium in high abundance, that's what drives the plate tectonics, the billions of years of plate tectonics on planet Earth that's critical for making the planet a just-right body for advanced life. If people want to see more on that, there's a magazine article I wrote called The Faint Sun Paradox, which explains why you have to have a planet with a huge amount of uranium and thorium. It's also explained in the book that we carry, Rare Earth.
Mm-hmm. Let's go talk to our friend Chris in Charlotte. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. And first, I'd like to thank you for posting that link to the question I had about human origins a few weeks ago.
Oh, sure.
I appreciate that.
I try.
You did well. Okay, well, today I have a cosmology question for Dr. Ross, and it's about an article that I kind of skimmed, and to be honest, I've had a really hard time understanding it. It was called The Beginning of the End of the Anthropic Principle, and this appeared in New Astronomy, Volume 7, in 2002. And from what I can tell, they're trying to say that if string theory is correct, then there's almost no room for anthropic arguments in cosmology. They say that the quark and lepton masses and interaction strength are determined. And I have no idea what they're trying to argue here, and I'm trying to see what that would mean for the anthropic principle.
Well, I've not read that paper, and I notice it's 2002. The New Astronomer, you said?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll try to trace that down, or if you can just email the thing to us, that'd be great, the address.
Sure, sure.
But here's what I would guess is they're talking about. They're talking about string theory and grand unified field theories. And there have been a number of theoreticians who have speculated that maybe all of physics will reduce down to a single equation, a single elegant equation, out of which would flow all the other equations of physics. Or to put it in the context of unified field theory, most physicists are persuaded that when the universe is extremely young and extremely hot, you just have one superforce. Gravity, electromagnetism, the weak and strong nuclear force would unite to be one force. And as the universe cools, it splits into three forces and two forces and one force. Similar to what happens when you take a magnet and heat it up to about 600 degrees centigrade. What happens is the heat energy and the magnetic energy blend to become one source of energy. But if you let the magnet cool, that single source of energy will split into magnetic energy and heat energy. Likewise, we observe this to be the case for the weak nuclear force and the force of electromagnetism. If you heat some matter hot enough, those two blend together and become an electroweak force. So that's the basis of unified field physics. But when you get down to just a single force of physics rather than four forces of physics, that means you're only fine-tuning one force rather than four forces. So my guess is the force of this article is to say we really don't have the need for these dozens of different fine-tuned characteristics. If everything is really reducible to a single equation or a single small set of constants, then we don't have to fine-tune dozens. We only have to fine-tune a few, and doesn't that reduce the supernatural nature that comes out of the anthropic principle? Well, here's a fallacy in that line of argument. It is true that by that means you're reducing the number of constants, you're reducing the number of forces, you're reducing the number of equations. But in order to get advanced life in the universe, what you discover is that you have to very dramatically increase the fine-tuning of that simple elegance of the one equation of the universe or one force of physics to a far greater degree than you would the dozens of constants that we observe today that must be fine-tuned. You're not really getting rid of the design or the fine-tuning. You're simply trading it. You're trading one set of fine-tuning for another set of fine-tuning. You're not reducing the level of fine-tuning. You're just simply moving around. So this is equivalent to moving furniture from the living room to the dining room. I mean, you're really not changing the structure of your home or the design of your home. You're just simply moving things around. And this has been something that many theoretical physicists have commented on, is that by focusing on one design feature, you can find ways to reduce that level of design, But to make that reduction work, you have to increase the design somewhere else.
Okay.
Is there any way we can test that, Hugh, by going back and looking at, say, this the combining of the two forces that you mentioned into this electroweak force? Is there any way that we can look at that electroweak force and the constants and equations that represent that force and see that indeed it's more finely tuned than the two forces that the electromagnetic force and the
David, it hasn't been done in that case for a very good reason. It has been done in other cases. So let me explain to you first why you can't do that in the case of the unification of the electroweak. Because of the extreme high temperatures and densities in which unification takes place, you can't really test the fine-tuning at that level for life, because life can't exist under those conditions.
Yes.
We're talking about a universe that I think exceeds 10 to the 18 degrees Kelvin. So, however, there are other areas where you can put it to the test. One area that's very dynamic right now is looking at the dark energy term and the mass density term, mm-hmm. which are the highest fine-tuned characteristics we can measure anywhere in physics. And people have been asking the question, you know, is there some way we can bring the dark energy fine-tuning down from 1 part in 10 to the 240th or 1 part in 10 to the 120th to something that...
More reasonable.
Yeah, exactly. More reasonable, where we wouldn't need this God of the Bible to explain right. that degree of fine-tuning. And what they do is they invent what they call quintessence factors. For example, if we were to allow for a very tiny variation in the velocity of light when the universe is extremely
or
young.
Or this fine structure constant.
Or the fine structure constant, or the electromagnetic charge, then we can indeed reduce the level of fine tuning we see in the dark energy term. The problem is you have to inject more fine tuning into this quintessence factor, mm-hmm. whatever it is. And what you discover is that you're actually making the design greater rather than lesser. Mm-hmm. You're not really reducing the overall level of design. You're only reducing the design in one category of cosmic structure. And so that's one place where you can put it to the test. And there we demonstrate, no, we don't really get rid of the design. And there's been a number of theoretical physicists, I can't remember their names off the top of my head, who therefore concluded, and this isn't the only example, other examples where we've seen this as well, who have concluded that it's no matter where you go in physics, you're not going to reduce the fine-tuning. We're simply trading one for another. On the other hand, they do argue that we should continue to pursue, say, quintessence. Quintessence might be real, and frankly, I agree with them. As we make more detailed measurements of the early history of the universe, we may indeed discover that there is a quintessence factor there. But in discovering it, we should expect to uncover more evidence for supernatural design, not less.
Now, isn't it true that the cosmologists are hoping, let's say in producing this ultimate grand unified theory, this one ultimate equation with all the forces unified, that somehow there will be some constants in that equation that are fixed. They aren't just arbitrary and therefore subject to fine-tuning.
That has been an expressed hope, although I could quote to you from Stephen Hawking. He says, you know, if we come up with this, we're going to discover that this super equation is so incredibly elegant that by itself would argue that there would have to be
a god
to explain the elegance and the beauty and the majesty of this simple equation or this unified field theory.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is probably the grounds on which he then, as an individual, would agree with a sort of a deist kind of God, that there is some kind of a God, an agent or a designer, but he would take a sort of deist approach that God isn't a personal God involved in our world. Is that correct?
That's correct. He has said that very directly in several of his books, most pointedly in A Brief History of Time. He also claims that this elegant theory of everything, as he refers to it, is discoverable. Mm-hmm. And if we find that theory, we'll know everything that God knows.
Right.
And so he says that's his personal quest to uncover the mind of God. Right. So he's not denying that there's a God. He's not denying that this God has an incredibly brilliant mind. But where he is coming up against Christian theology is claiming that we human beings can become like God and know as much as God mm-hmm. knows.
Does that help you out, Chris?
It does. And I think if you want to find the paper, I'll definitely email you the
bibliographic reference. Right.
Thank you. If you want to find it really fast, you can just do a Google search and search for the beginning of the end of the anthropic principle.
Okay. We'll try that.
Cool. Thank you very much.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Chris. Dave, about a couple of clarifying points you wanted to make about the radiometric dating discussion we were having earlier. I'm using radiometric dating as a technique to date the creation of the
right.
universe.
Well, I just was discussing with Hugh and asked the question, isn't it true that this radiometric dating method that we reported on in the first part of our program here, isn't it really giving a date that is independent of the particular models that have to go into, say, for instance, the WMAP?
That's correct.
And you want to respond to that, Hugh? Or?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, these three other methods, the WMAP, star burning, how long the oldest stars mm-hmm. can burn, and the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which measures the age of the universe based on the positions and the velocities of the galaxies. In each case, you're working with three different sets of models. Now, the models are independent of one another, mm-hmm. and therefore the fact that all three of them give the same date is very encouraging
exactly.
to believers in a cosmic creation event. This gives us a fourth method, and this fourth method is independent of any of the assumptions or models that go into these other three methods.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that it's producing the same date is even more encouraging mm-hmm. to Big Bang cosmologists and anyone believing that there's a God that's responsible for creating this universe billions of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the dates are consistent, but bottom line, this method could give us a measurement that's even more accurate than anything we got out there today. So mm-hmm. I'm excitedly looking forward to what can happen in the next couple of years.
In a way, you could argue that it sort of works in both directions. It's not only nice that it's an independent method consistent with previously determined dates for the beginning of the universe, but it also serves to indicate that radiometric processes themselves must be as we expect that they are. They're not the radiometric process is not speeding up or slowing down
right.
as a function of time.
If it was, it would produce a date inconsistent with the other
exactly,
methods.
Right. Exactly.
And it's not doing that.
It's not doing that.
Right.
Okay, let's go out and talk to Billy in Windsor, Connecticut. Welcome, Billy.
Hi, Krista. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Well, I've been reading Rare Earth, and the authors mention the snowball Earth events in the Earth's history. And they say that several times before the Cambrian explosion, the Earth froze over except for a band around the equator.
Right.
I'd never heard this before. I think it's very intriguing and had some questions about it. Like, how was it that the Earth froze over at that point, and why isn't it still frozen? And did these snowball Earth events play a role in preparing the Earth for humanity?
Okay. There's some disagreement over how many snowball events the Earth experienced, somewhere between 2 and 5. And these would have occurred between about 600 million years ago and 900 million years ago. And there's a reason why they happened in that era and not earlier or later. In terms of earlier than 900 million years ago, the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere of the Earth would have prevented these snowball events from occurring. But as the greenhouse gases dropped, then they could form. And the reason why we don't see them after 600 million years is that we're in an era, the sun has been getting brighter and brighter for the past 3 billion years as it converts hydrogen to helium. The conversion of hydrogen to helium in the core of the sun, that extra helium causes the density of the core to go up, which makes the furnace inside the sun burn hotter. And so we've been in an era for the past 3 billion years where the sun gets progressively hotter and hotter and hotter. And what God does is he creates just the right life forms at just the right time to take out enough greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. So as the sun gets hotter, our atmosphere becomes less efficient in its capacity to trap heat. But because of the increase in the luminosity of the sun, these snowball events have not been possible after 600 million years. And I think that's one explanation why we have the Cambrian explosion dated at 543 million years ago. Bringing advanced life on planet Earth and preparing the biodeposits of the crust for humanity, you really don't want that advanced life interrupted by these snowball events. And so that would be one reason why the Creator would wait until after the snowball events before bringing about the Cambrian explosion and this continuance of advanced life. Now, your question was specifically, how would the late heavy bombardment have benefited life today on planet Earth?
The snowball Earth event.
Yeah, how these snowball events would have done that. That's an area of ongoing research. I can't give you a clear answer to that right now. Obviously, a snowball event would have brought to extinction huge amounts of life on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
In order to prepare the planet for human life, there is a need to remove life to make room for new life. And all the mass extinction events we see in the fossil record, we can figure out why the removal of life was critical in order to make habitat space for the new life forms that would have been better adapted for the changing conditions of the solar system and better for salting the Earth with the biodeposits that would facilitate human civilization. The problem with the snowball events is we're now going so far back into the history of the Earth, previous to 600 million years, that we just don't have as good data as we do for the mass extinction events after 600 million years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more difficult to give you a good answer to your question because we simply don't know exactly what life forms are on the face of the Earth before the snowball events or after the snowball events.
Okay.
So in that sense, I got to duck your question.
Okay.
Perhaps 5 years from now, if you call back again, we can give you a definitive answer.
Hey, that would be great.
Okay.
But once the Earth froze over to that extent, why wasn't it just a runaway cooling? How is it that it unfroze again?
Oh, how did it unfroze? That is well understood. And before I do that, there is one paper I can think of that speculates why these snowball events would have been critical. Glaciation creates fjords, and fjords create nice harbors. They also create the concentration of metal ores.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in the northern latitude or the high latitudes, we see lots of fjords, and we see ore deposits we don't see elsewhere on the Earth. So having a few snowball events would have permitted harbors to form at lower latitudes and would have also permitted metal ores to form at those lower latitudes. So that's one reason I can think of, two reasons, as to why you want snowball events covering 90% of the Earth's surface with ice.
Is this some sort of argument for a human civilization? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, you would like to have metal ores not just in the high latitudes but lower latitudes as well where people are living, where they can exploit them. And you'd also like to have at least a few good harbors at those lower latitudes. And snowball events could do that for you. Although the one proviso in all that is plate tectonics seems to reform the surface of the Earth on timescales equivalent to the last snowball event. So again, yeah. I can't give you a high precision answer to that. And at this point, I've forgotten your main point.
There was a question she had.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Well, I think you've been answering them.
Well, the question you had was what causes these things to warm up again?
Yeah, what causes them to warm up again? Right. Okay. You have these volcanic events proceeding. So what a snowball event does is it shuts down a lot of life activity on planet Earth, which would be sucking up carbon dioxide. But at the same time, you got volcanoes erupting greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And so without a lot of life being on the planet, those volcanoes would gradually pull the greenhouse gas quantity higher and higher in the atmosphere, and it reaches a point where that now traps enough heat from the sun that the snowball event would end. The ice would melt, and you start over again.
Okay.
But then you get another snowball event after that because of the fact that it's not the same greenhouse gas quantity or solar luminosity as we have today.
So during the snowball events, was the Earth wasn't still covered by water? There were continental land masses?
Yes. And the Rare Earth book, I think, has a diagram in there which shows you the growth of the continental land masses over the history of the Earth.
Okay.
And we'll show you that continental land masses and islands covered less than 3% of the Earth's surface until about 2.4 billion years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And between 2.4 billion and about 600 million, it increases to a little bit more than 20% of the surface of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And the last 600 million years, it's gone from 22% to 29%. And in a billion years or so, it'll get up to 30%.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Billy. Always good to hear from a female caller. He was, as we were talking to the caller earlier about the grand unified
field theory.
Field theory, yes. It made me wonder if, I mean, you guys weren't saying this, but it seemed like it was kind of lurking in the background there, that this is an attempt, in a way, to kind of get around the God question. I mean, it does have certain metaphysical implications to it.
That's true for some theoretical physicists. Other theoretical physicists actually look at it from the same motivation we do, that if we can get some deeper understanding of what unites all of these forces of physics, it's going to give us even more evidence for the supernatural than we have today. So there's some that are studying it because they think they can get around the supernatural. Others are studying it because they think they can uncover more of the fingerprints of the supernatural creator.
Or it's just not an issue with them at all.
Yeah, some of them just don't care one way or the other.
Yeah, they're just studying physics because it's fun.
Right, right. One of the distractions of the human race is that we have all this fun physics. It keeps us from thinking about the most important issues of life.
Right.
You and I worked with a lot of people that were like that.
Sure.
They were just so fascinated and motivated that
they didn't want to go home at night and have to deal with their kids.
Right.
Or their wife. More often than you'd like to believe, it was that case.
Okay, Hugh, let's do a quick email question
email?
Here from Todd in Sacramento. I can't remember if we've done this one before or not, but it's an interesting question about fluorine, and he wanted to know if fluorine was only produced on white dwarfs, and if this has anything to do with supernova. Like, do we get fluorine from supernova, and what is it that's so special about fluorine?
Okay, well, fluorine is critical for advanced life. I mean, you've heard about fluoride water, so you can have strong
teeth.
Oh,
so it's related
teeth.
To fluoride.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. So,
cool.
So fluorine
is
not the most common life essential element, but it is a life essential element. And fluorine is made in several places astrophysically in the universe. However, to get a large amount of fluorine, you would need a special kind of white dwarf binary star. And so that's one of the design features of the solar system, is that it's rather fluorine-rich, richer than we would expect, which is a sign that the solar system must have formed adjacent to one of these special kinds of white dwarf binary stars that produces copious amounts of fluorine and ejects it into the interstellar medium. It's not enough just to make the fluorine. There's got to be some way to get it into the interstellar medium where new stars can form. So white dwarf binaries are really the only way you're going to make a large amount of this fluorine for advanced life.
And I would like to welcome now, joining us in studio, is our staff theologian and philosopher, Kenneth Samples. Welcome, Ken.
Hi.
And we are possibly, we'll see how far we get here, going to wrap up our series today on creation ex nihilo. I think we're up to part 6 now. And I do want to give out the phone number, because I know many of you enjoy talking to Ken. If you have questions about cult apologetics or the inerrancy of Scripture or Roman Catholicism, UFO cults, any of those topics, or a wide variety of other biblical topics, now's a good time to get on the phone, 866-RTB-RADIO, so you can ask Ken your questions. Okay, Ken, let's talk a little bit about this phrase in Genesis 1. Over and over again, God pronounces the creation good. Then on the sixth day, he pronounces everything very good. God's very good creation. And yet there are some philosophies out there who would say that the physical creation is actually kind of an evil or a counterpoint to it. Like God is spiritual and the physical creation is evil. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, very good. This is an important part of creation ex nihilo. Obviously, God is the only independent being. God is completely good, righteous, holy. He brings the universe into existence by his power and his wisdom alone. And he declares that it is good. And this runs in contrast to some ancient philosophies, as well as ideas that are existent in the present. The idea that somehow there is an intrinsic evil as part of the universe. Here I'm thinking of two prominent philosophies. One was the group called the Manichees or Manichaeanism. St. Augustine was part of this group for 9 years of his life and then later repudiated it. They believed that there were two gods, a good God and an evil God. Augustine had a hard time with Christianity initially because he couldn't quite figure out how a good God could allow evil in a world that he made. He thought at least the Manichees account for it. The good God made the good, the evil God made the bad. And probably the predecessor of Manichaeanism is a religion that still exists today, though it's very small and shrinking. It is Zoroastrianism. And in the religion of Zoroastrianism, which came out of ancient Persia, they also have two gods, or gods that emanate from the ultimate God, one being good and one being evil. And so because of the doctrine of creation ex nihilo, because of God's righteousness and goodness, creation ex nihilo would reject any religious philosophy that would say that the universe has an intrinsic evil. Now, this doesn't rule out that God created an angelic realm and that angelic realm had some kind of influence on the earth, but Christianity does not affirm that matter is evil, that the physical material universe in and of itself is in any way intrinsically evil.
And sometimes even we as Christians don't realize how subtle forms of this can even, I think, get into our own thinking, you know, that sometimes we'll think, well, you know, it's better to be spiritual person than to, even in our job situations, I'm thinking sometimes we have a very matter is evil sort of view. Like if I have a secular job, somehow that is less glorifying to God than having a quote unquote spiritual job for the kingdom of God. But it's not exactly the same as the physical order, but that kind of dualism sometimes can creep into our thinking.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about false doctrine. Having worked with Walter Martin at the Christian Research Institute years ago, I've thought a lot about the dangers that heresies represent in the church. It's hard to think of a more pernicious error than Gnosticism. And a very important part of Gnosticism was the idea that the spiritual was good, that matter somehow was contaminated by evil. And certainly these groups I've mentioned, the Manichees, had certain Gnostic tendencies. And maybe one idea that we have carried forward is somehow that there is the sacred-secular distinction. I remember thinking as a very young Christian, well, I'm a Christian now. I want to serve the Lord. I should become a pastor. I should become a minister. What I realized later, however, is that being a scientist, being a teacher, being a mechanic or a soldier, as my father was, those are just as honorable. Playing chess is no more Christian than playing hockey. What'd you think about that, Hugh?
And even
as a good Canadian.
Well, I gave up chess because I didn't like the aggressive.
You're not cutthroat enough, are you, Hugh?
Well, I was very cutthroat before I became a believer. When I became a believer, I actually stopped playing tournament chess just because I said, you know, the way you win at chess is you destroy your opponent's psyche. And I didn't see that as being consistent with a Christian lifestyle.
What about, I'm thinking, Ken, too, about physical pleasures. Sometimes we'll think, well, physical pleasures like sex or something like that, is that sort of more base than a spiritual pleasure?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that, because in the Manichae group, and again, this very few people today, I'm sure, have any idea about the Manichaeans, but it was such an influential group that it preoccupied Augustine's mind for 9 years. The Manichaeans had a basic view that the people who were advanced Manichaeans, they did not engage in sexual conduct at all. And Augustine, who was only a hearer, he was not an advanced member of this group. He rationalized his own sexual sin by saying, well, the body doesn't really matter anyway. And so this is, I think, another implication of the incipient nature of kind of a Gnostic idea, as opposed to the Bible, where I think clearly in Paul's statements, a man and a woman who are married can make love to the glory of God. Having a committed relationship that includes the physical side of life, bearing children, all of this brings glory to God. There's nothing inherently sinful about a sexual relationship that takes place within the context of covenant marriage.
Now, Ken, Zoroastrianism is making a comeback, I notice, in the 21st century. Do they hold that same view on sex?
Well, I don't know that they do.
From what I've been told, they don't. They take a different view on sex, but they do take this view that there's this good versus evil.
Yeah, they have a they have an ultimate god. Hura Mazda is mm-hmm. the title that is given to him. My understanding is, for many, many years, no one could actually join the Zoroastrian religion. You had to be born into it. The priesthood was something that was given only to people who were born into it. So it has really seriously dropped in numbers. But interestingly enough, the Zoroastrians in India and in other parts of the world are often given the most prestigious positions because they have a very high ethical conduct and principle. And it is monotheistic. Technically, they believe in one God, though they have these two forces emanating. And that's where it's very similar to Manichaeanism.
Right. Another question I wanted to raise to you, Ken, is I see this with my son's peer group, that, this idea that there's something evil about nature. And from what I can understand, it stems out of the idea that, work isn't pleasant. And we have all this pain and suffering that we go through. And so I remember getting into a debate with them about, well, it's not that work is evil. The curse that was pronounced upon humanity is that we would do more work. And what makes work frustrating is the fact that in order to accomplish a certain task, we wind up wasting a lot of time and effort. But that's not how God intended. God intended labor to be joyful, to be good. He pronounced the creation good, and that includes the labor. It also includes the pain we experience. That in the context where sin is not getting in the way, the pain we experience is actually something very good. It warns us of danger. Without pain, there would be no physical touch or pleasure that comes from the sense of touch. Who'd want to give up that?
Yes.
But I notice with young people, there's this idea, maybe it's because they're not instilled with the work ethic like we were when we were raised, that there's this perception that maybe there is something fundamentally evil about nature just because of the unpleasantness of... What do you think?
I think you're right. Yeah, Hugh, my father grew up during the Depression. He was an American during the World War II era. My dad loved to work. Working was not only something he did because that's how he put food on the table, but now in reflecting back on his life, I can tell that he received great pleasure from work. I have really kind of transitioned in my own life, Hugh. I used to think that I had a job. I don't think that way anymore. I now believe I have a vocation in life. And I believe that what I do here at Reasons to Believe, my involvement in my church, the raising of my children, my relationship with my wife, all of these are things that God has called me to. And this is part of that greater calling that He has on my life in terms of His Lordship. I wish I had a greater work ethic like my father. When I was a teenager, if this will give you some encouragement, I thought work was a four-letter word. but I have since to come to realize that though my father never made as much money as I, nor did he have as good an education as I have had, there are many ways in which my father was far ahead of me in terms of virtue, and one of them is in the area of work ethic.
Well, maybe go ahead.
I got to move on.
All right.
Okay, let's get one more point in here before the end of our segment. Let's talk a little bit about creation out of nothing excludes any pre-existent or chaotic contingent entities. So what are we talking about here? Is this the idea of a kind of reincarnating universe, or what do we have in view here?
Well, the idea is that with creation ex nihilo, there's no pre-existing material. God, by His infinite wisdom and His awesome power, He calls things that don't exist and makes them exist. He speaks the universe into existence. Well, there have been groups both in the ancient world and today that believe there is pre-existing materials. An example, I think, today that's very clear is in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. They believe that there are these pre-existent souls. There is chaotic matter. And so Mormonism does not affirm in a classical sense creation ex nihilo. And this is one of the points, Krista, that I think has been important about this series. Not only do heretical groups, cults, alternative religions deny the doctrine of the Trinity and our Christological views that Jesus is the God-man, not only do they distort the gospel, often saying that people are redeemed by works, but it's interesting to me in working on this worldview book that virtually all of the other religions and cults also distort the doctrine of creation in some powerful way. And so one of the points I try to drive forward in my book is that creation is a critical Christian doctrine because it lays the foundation for so many other areas that are important to us.
It really highlights this point that Christian beliefs are all interconnected.
That's right.
If you start tinkering around with one, not always, but it can have a very devastating impact and even a domino effect in other areas of belief.
That is exactly right. If you distort the Trinity, your Christology will be fouled up. Undoubtedly, your soteriology or view of salvation will be messed up, and inevitably, the doctrine of creation is distorted in one way or another. So, while creation ex nihilo has fallen on hard times, and while there are people who aren't willing to assert that the Bible teaches it, I think it is a foundational biblical and Christian doctrine that deserves being defended.
And I'm thinking here, I'm looking on your notes about the chaotic element of it. So I've heard some people try to approach Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, where in verse 2 in particular, it talks about God kind of crafting the world out of the world was tohu wabohu. It was formless and void in the English, that is somehow describing this chaotic state that is present in so many ancient Near Eastern creation myths. What would you say to that?
Well, I think that's probably a very good case of eisegesis, that is reading into the text. I think it's very clear that obviously in the early stages of the earth was not yet hospitable to life. It was progressing toward a place where God could then create the first life forms. But to suggest that there are hidden races of people, or that there is a gap where various things took place. I don't think that that expresses the best form of biblical interpretation with regard to this great book of Genesis. And again, while not all answers in Genesis, Genesis is a foundational Christian book that then influences so many other areas of the Christian scriptures.
Well, Ken, since creation ex nihilo is such a foundational doctrine of the Christian faith, I take it that you're really excited that scientists have now proven the creation ex nihilo independent of the Bible.
You know, Hugh, I don't know that you know this, but the first time I heard you talk, I was very excited about your presentation of Big Bang cosmology. And the reason was, it was because I thought it was such a powerful affirmation, not only of the cosmological argument that I have always believed has great potency, but I was also excited because I thought, you know, this is right at the heart of what Christians for centuries have been saying about the book of Genesis and about God's power in creation. And so I remember the first time hearing you talk about that, thinking, wow, this is, I can use this as a powerful evidence to support Christian truth claims.
It seems to me, too, what you're putting in your book is how this creation ex nihilo is a doctrine that really does distinguish biblical Christian faith from all the other competing religions that are out there.
That's exactly right. And it seems to me, Hugh, that maybe the best way of illustrating both the truth of Christianity and how it differs from other worldviews is simply to lay out those distinctive Christian truths and then to show how the various religious systems and skeptical systems end up in some way or another denying them.
Let me tell you where I get excited, Ken, by your work. Sometimes I'm laying out all this scientific evidence for an actual beginning of space-time, matter, and energy, and a causal agent creating all that independent of space-time, matter, and energy, audience will say, well, what's that got to do with Jesus Christ? Well, what your work is showing is it's got everything to do with Jesus Christ, because non-Christian religions don't teach that doctrine of creation ex nihilo and that specific of a matter.
I agree. You know, Hugh, studying philosophy, I think the field of cosmology has powerful philosophical and theological implications. And so here is where I would say general revelation and special revelation overlap in a way that I think is very inviting for people to consider the truth of the Christian faith.
Well, a famous philosopher once made this complaint, that astronomers have stolen cosmology from the philosophers.
Well, I'm willing to share it. I certainly learned a lot from cosmologists and astronomers such as yourself.
Well, thank you, Ken. This has been a good series, and we'll figure out what we're going to do starting up next week. And I want to invite everyone, if you're listening, to give us a call, 866-RTB-RADIO, if you'd love to jump into our discussion. We would love to hear from you with your questions about science and the Bible. Okay, let's talk to Walter out in Dallas.
Hi, I'd like to just give a kudos to Dave Rungstedt. Last hour, his critical banter about the static universe, I really enjoyed. My question is really to Psalm 148, where it talks about where it includes the sun and the moon as being established forever and ever.
Right.
I thought your model was one where the new creation, where the earth actually, like Hebrews 1:10-12 talk about it, it is, well, melted and actually gets replaced.
How do I deal with this?
Yeah.
Okay. If you want to see something in print, I got a few pages on it in my latest book, A Matter of Days, because we have in the young Earth creationist camp the belief that the stars and galaxies will remain forever.
Now, not all young Earth creationists believe that.
Not all young Earth creationists believe that.
I don't want people writing to me. It's just a certain contingent.
Well, like Danny Faulkner, for example, clearly does not.
Right.
But Henry Morris clearly does, and he's written a number of articles to the effect that this is the way it's got to be. And there was this tape series, something about Eden before. What was it called?
Let's see. Ours is called Life and Death in Eden. I think that one's called After Eden.
Right. There was like six young Earth creationists, yeah, and all six endorse this view that the stars and the stars will burn forever based on this passage in Psalm 148. Now, what I did in a matter of days is, first of all, provide a list of all the passages in the Bible that make it clear that the stars are temporary. And there's like 15 different passages. And, you know, Henry Morris was only able to pull up three passages, two from the Old Testament, one from the New Testament, that suggest that the stars might last forever. And this was the key verse, this one in Psalm 148. Based what you see here, let me get it up. It says, yeah, he commanded and they were created. He set them in place forever and ever. He gave a decree that will never pass away. Referring to praise him, sun and moon, praise him above you shining stars, praise him, you highest heavens and you waters above the skies. Now, what you'll see in some commentaries in Psalm 148, that he set them in place forever and ever, is referring to these highest heavens, and that the shining stars is a symbol that's used for the angels. In fact, the stars are defined as a symbol in Revelation chapter 1, for example. So that's one way people have dealt with it. Another way that some of the commentaries have dealt with this is to make the point that this is Hebrew, it's not Greek. And that the Hebrew language, the word that's translated of forever, has two possible definitions. It could mean for all of eternity. It could mean simply for a long period of time. And for example, you've got passages in the Levitical law making the point that God had established the Aaronic priesthood to last forever. And yet it's quite clear in the New Testament that when Jesus was crucified and raised from the dead, that put an end to the Aaronic priesthood. But given that the Hebrew word there can mean literally for all eternity or simply for a long period of time, we see that the Aaronic priesthood does not need to be understood as something that lasts truly forever. Likewise, in Psalm 148, even if this is referring to the physical stars rather than the heavenly stars or the angels, this does not necessarily mean that they last forever. But I think what's most helpful is to get into the dozen-plus passages that make it crystal clear that the stars are temporary. You'll see passages, for example, refer to them vanishing, disappearing like smoke. It uses word pictures to that effect. The New Testament makes it very clear that God will replace this universe with a new universe where stars will not form at all or even exist. Revelation 22, there will be no stars in the new creation. So with those passages and given how specific and clear those passages are, I think we're quite correct in saying that Psalm 148 doesn't truly mean that physical stars will last forever and forever. But there's two ways that commentaries handle this.
Okay, what especially confused me about that, I know there are some passages where it just uses forever once, but this says forever and ever, and I don't know, I guess you're saying that the number of times that it's used where it's fairly clear, where in this case they're kind of lumped together, that...
Right, and I believe I can check this out, but you know, if you look at the different English translations, not all of them say forever and ever.
I looked at a number, and they did.
They did,
forever and forever, or forever and ever. It's ad olam, ad olam.
Yeah, the word is olam.
But it has ad, A-D, in front of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the word olam or ad olam does not have to mean for all of eternity. It can. I mean, you've got a phrase, for example, in Ecclesiastes 3:14, using the same phrase that you know, God has created eternity in the hearts of human beings. This word olam can mean for a very long period of time, either into the future or into the past.
How did they get forever and ever? from that?
Well, it's the choice of the English translator how to translate this particular passage. But as I say, we're looking with Hebrew. This is not Greek. In Greek, you actually have a word that can specifically mean only for all eternity. That's not the case in Hebrew. You don't have a word in Hebrew that only means for all of eternity. This word has considerable flexibility, either in the past or the present.
So
it can be a long time, or it could really be eternal. You have to take your choice.
So are you saying Psalm 148, verse 6, that an alternate translation might be that God set them in place
to burn for a very
long period of time, that they're very ancient.
Right.
They go back a long ways.
They go back a long ways. Okay. Or an alternate way of translating that word olam is that they could go forward for a long ways.
Yeah.
We don't know whether it's referring to how long they've been burning in the past or how long they can burn in the future. And my theology would say it's referring to the past.
And that's a good point. And I want to tell Walter and other listeners that I'm looking it up in the Hebrew right now, and Hugh is absolutely correct. It can either go a long ways into the past or a long ways into the future, and that flexibility is there, and you could go with that as an alternate translation.
It could even be eternity in the past,
right,
or eternity in the future,
right,
but there's nothing that compels you to translate it as eternity in the past or the future. What is compelled is we're talking a significant passage of time. But keep in mind that same word is used of the Aaronic priesthood. And it did indeed last for a significant period of time. It wasn't just one or two generations. But clearly, the Aaronic priesthood is done and over with.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, well, I hope that helps you out, Walter.
Yeah, if you want this in all of its gory detail, it's a matter of days. I mean, I actually list for you all the verses.
Okay.
Where it clearly states that the stars are temporary and not eternal. See, the Bible can't contradict itself. You can't take this one ambiguous passage to overturn a dozen passages that are non-ambiguous.
That's always a good interpretive principle when
right.
Approaching Scripture, assuming that you believe that there are no contradictions
exactly.
in Scripture. You're going to
exactly.
have to sort of try to sort this all out.
Another plug for systematic theology. Before you make a stand on a particular point of Bible interpretation, you want to look up every relevant verse in the Bible.
Yeah, you want to be careful of what I call one-verse theology, where you got one verse and then you're overturning your entire system with that.
Exactly.
Because that's what cults do.
Right.
Not to say that young earth people are cults, but that's just a common methodology that cults will employ.
Well, that was my main critique of Henry Morris's position. He was looking at three passages of Scripture and ignoring all the other passages that said the opposite.
Now, I noticed in a recent publication from the Institute for Creation Research that John Morris has sort of a similar view about the planets, that possibly is a speculation that we will that those could last for
yeah,
a long
I think
period
that showed
of time.
Up in the latest issue of Acts and Facts.
Yeah,
that,
I've got it here. I'm looking at it on my laptop on the internet here. They've
right.
got it on their
Although
website.
John is careful to say that he is speculating.
It is a speculation, yeah.
Right.
But that's kind of interesting that there are some components of or some fractions of the young earth position that would hold to that
That's not just young earth, Krista. I see that as well in the Reconstruction theology movement, this idea that this earth, this universe will last forever, and that's where our final state will be. So I don't want to just pick on the young earth creationists.
Right, absolutely. That's a good clarification.
On the other hand, I do want to emphasize this is an important doctrine. I mean, if Ken were here, I think you'd back me up and just say, you know, the fact that we see elements of the Christian community today, the evangelical Christian community, toying with the idea that this earth or this universe is eternal, this has profound theological consequences for the rest of Christian doctrine. And therefore, you know, we should be, in fact, I'm much more concerned about this turn of events in the young earth camp than I am about their stand on the age of the universe.
And once again, our friend Fuzz Rana is enjoying the Bay Area up in Northern California this week with his family, getting some much-deserved time off with them. So he'll be back next week with us, and I'm sure he'll have a host of things to talk to us about. It always seems like something big happens in the summertime while he's gone on vacation. Okay, Hugh, let's talk a little bit about symbiosis. And if I remember right, a couple years ago, five-species symbiosis discovery we talked about made it to our top 10 of the whole year. I think that was in 2003.
That's right.
And these are always sort of fascinating discussions because it is the complexity of symbiotic relationships is our understanding of the complexity is growing, and it's not just we're finding one species relying on another species for its well-being, but actually many species being interconnected and interdependent upon one another.
Right.
Which is a pretty, I think you would say, is a strong evidence of a divine designer. On the flip side, some strong, compelling evidence against natural process evolution.
Yeah, it's showing a level of complexity in the creation of life and the way life relates to one another that you wouldn't otherwise get. And it also shows that by having different species of life specialize on the one area of provision for the benefit not only of itself but other species actually shows you an optimality in the design of life. And the one we're going to talk about today is a well-known symbiosis, but we now understand some details about that symbiosis we didn't understand before that really does show a great elegance of design. And this concerns fungus and how fungus plays a role in fixing nitrogen for green plants. And the particular fungus we're talking about is a class of fungi known as arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. You think physicists come up with 50-cent terms. You should see what the biologists and biochemists come up with. So it's one thing I'm learning and relating with Fuzz is how to talk in 5- and 6-syllable words. But I can't quite do it as smoothly as Fuzz.
Yeah, it kind of trips off the tongue real easy for him.
Right. So just like equations do, I guess, for Dave and I.
That's but, right.
Anyway, the particular relationship here is that these mycorrhizal fungi transform inorganic nitrogen into amino acids that the plants cannot make for themselves. So they're taking the nitrogen that's in the soil, converting it into amino acids, providing it for the plants. And what the plants give the fungi are carbohydrates. And carbohydrates, those are sugars. Those are the fuel of life. And so the plants provide food to the fungi. The fungi provide these critical amino acid nutrients to the plants. Now, what I'm talking about here are actually two separate research papers, one published by a team of Americans, the other by a team of Japanese. And what the Japanese have discovered is that plants release into the soil special signaling molecules, and they've been able to identify exactly what these signaling molecules are. Here's another 50-cent term. It's strigolactone 5-deoxystrigol. Probably wish I didn't say all that. But that's their discovery. They identified the molecule, and they also demonstrated how that molecule works to communicate to the fungi the best locations for them to branch, because that's what these fungi do. They kind of bud and branch. And so these signaling molecules communicate to the fungi the best locations for them to branch so that they can make the best possible contact between the branching points and the plant's roots so that these amino acids can be taken up. What the American team discovered are the specific chemical pathways and genes that control these pathways that direct the amino acids produced by the fungi to the correct locations within the plant's root system so that the plant could now absorb these nutrients and take advantage of them. And in both cases, the level of design ingenuity and optimization is truly spectacular. That's what impressed me in reading the papers. So spectacular that I just begs the fact that there's got to be a creator who had intended long ago that Earth's continents would be filled with advanced life and animals. And I need to backtrack a minute there. Without this symbiotic relationship, about 80% of the advanced plants we see on the Earth would not exist, and we would not have the colonization of the continental land masses with plants. Only a tiny percentage of the continental land masses would be colonized by advanced plants. And if it wasn't for this symbiotic relationship, these plants wouldn't be there. And if they're not there, you can't have advanced animals on those continental land masses. And clearly for human life to exist and to successfully launch civilization, you need both an abundance of advanced plants and advanced animals on all the continental land masses.
I'm reminded of Genesis 1, where we see that purposeful progression of the Creator, and the land masses appear first, the water separate, the land masses appear, and then plants begin to grow, and then we see the kind of the clouds parting and the appearance of the sun and the moon, and that's all in preparation for the animals that are going to come later on in,
right.
in God's creation. And it's all interconnected, and the plants really are the base of what you need in order to have life and complex life.
They are, and what's critical for human civilization, especially global human civilization, is that this life be abundant and ubiquitous. And so that's what this symbiotic relationship permits, is for advanced plants to be ubiquitous on the continental land masses and to be able to exist in truly abundant proportions so that then you can have abundant animal life in advanced form. And this is what's going to enable human civilization to proceed. But just to be super accurate on this, Krista, when I said all the continental land masses, I was not including Antarctica.
Okay.
But
we'll probably get someone writing in about that, so that's a good clarification.
As far as the six other continents are concerned, without this fungus, and it's actually a whole suite of different fungi species, then we simply wouldn't have all these advanced plants and animals in the quantity and the extent that we see.
The intricacies of this and the thoughtful planning of the Creator are just truly astounding at times, and the more we learn, the more these evidences.
All these particular molecules, the signaling molecules, and the genes that are controlling how these nutrients, these amino acids, get into the right parts of the plants. That is where I'm really just blown away. I mean, just looking at the design of those molecules and how those molecules are organized to make this whole system work. It's actually two design arguments here, Krista. You got the design of the specific molecules, then you got the organization of these molecules that argue for a supernatural creator that is performing optimal design creations.
Should we do a quick email?
Yeah, let's
before
do a quick email.
Before the end of the hour. We had one, I think, earlier from Tim in Sacramento, and here's the second one. This wasn't planned. It just came in and worked out that way. But Tim had some questions about mitochondrial DNA that we wanted to try to clear up, because Tim's questions are typical of questions that come up a lot. So it's good to spend time on this. He says, I understand there's a difference between human male and female mitochondrial dates. The males seem to be much younger, as would be predicted by RTB's universal flood model. I have some questions on mitochondrial dating. First, how is the age of mitochondrial DNA determined? What is the date for male mitochondrial DNA? And what is the date given for female mitochondrial DNA? We'll pause there and then get to the other questions as
sure.
time allows.
Well, a clarification here is we're not comparing male mitochondrial DNA dating with female mitochondrial DNA dating, but rather mitochondrial DNA dating with Y chromosome DNA dating. All human beings get mitochondrial DNA from their mothers. And so both you and I, Krista, have mitochondrial DNA, but our fathers do not contribute. Only our mothers do.
Okay.
So when they talk about mitochondrial DNA, you're really tracing the female lineage. But it's not that we men are excluded. It's just that we men only get our mitochondrial DNA from our mothers. And the way the method works is that the only way my mitochondrial DNA can be different from my mother's is if I experience a natural mutation in my mitochondrial DNA. Same thing is true of you. And so because the man does not contribute to the passing on of mitochondrial DNA to the next generation, scientists can take mitochondrial DNA samples from people all over the world, all different ethnic groups, and in looking at the diversity expressed in these different samples of mitochondrial DNA, they can determine if we human beings are descended from one woman or many women and the location from which she came. And if you can dig up people who have been dead for a few hundred to a few thousand years, you can get a measure of the natural rate of mitochondrial DNA mutation, and that will give you an approximate date for the mitochondrial DNA. Now, that's contrasted with Y chromosome DNA dating. With Y chromosome, the women are out. It's only men, because, you know, only men have the Y chromosome. but it also means that I only get my Y chromosome from my father. It's similar to the mitochondrial DNA. The only way my Y chromosome DNA can differ from my dad's is if I experience a natural mutation. So it's the same technique. You sample people all over the planet, look at their Y chromosome, sample men, that is, not women, all over the planet, and you can basically test for the same thing. Are we descended from many men or one man from many regions or one region? And if you dig up people who have been dead for a while, then you can come up with an actual date for when that first man lived. Now, as we pointed out in a number of our writings, it's in the Genesis question. It'll be given exhaustively in our book on human origins, Who is Adam? That's coming out in September. When you look at stable populations, you do get an earlier date for the Y chromosome than you do the mitochondrial DNA.
Yeah, do we want to say how those compare?
It's not significantly earlier. We're talking only a few thousand years. Mitochondrial DNA dating comes in at about 50,000 years. Y chromosome comes in at about 50,000. When you look at the stable populations where there's not a lot of migration in or out, you do get an earlier date by a few thousand years. So it's just a few percent. But it is significant. It shows up in all the different stable populations we look at.
So real quickly, getting to Tim's other questions, is it RTB's position that the date for female or mitochondrial DNA shows the date of the Genesis flood?
No, our position is that the mitochondrial DNA will get you back earlier than the flood, possibly even all the way back to Eve herself, whereas the Y chromosome dating method is simply dating from a biblical perspective when Noah lived. Why? Because all the Y chromosomes that are in the human population today will bottleneck at the one man Noah, because the flood account tells us in the Bible that there are only four men on board Noah's ark, Noah and his three sons, and the three sons would have all gotten their Y chromosome from the one man Noah. So Y chromosome will not get you back to Adam. It would only get you back to Noah. Whereas the four women on board the ark, their mitochondrial DNA could literally go all the way back to Eve herself, since they're not blood related to one another. However, there could be a bottleneck between Eve and the time of the flood.
Now, can they use DNA dating techniques on animals, like the origin of animals?
They can. The problem is that trying to recover mitochondrial DNA deep in the fossil record really isn't going to be very successful. Why? Because DNA degrades fairly rapidly with time. And so as we note in our book, Who is Adam?, the technique is good for about the past 100,000 years. You're not going to be able to go back to the dinosaurs. And therefore, there's some limitation to how deeply you can explore the origins of, say, orangutans and chimpanzees. But with human beings and Neanderthals, the method works quite well. The other one proviso I'd give Krista is that the mitochondrial DNA dating isn't as accurate as the Y chromosome, because sometimes people get two copies of the mitochondrial DNA rather than a single copy. That's not everybody, but a small percentage gets two, a very small percentage gets three. And therefore, we have much larger error bars with the mitochondrial DNA dating than we do the Y chromosome dating.
Okay, Tim, I hope that helps you out. And I guess that concludes another edition of Creation Update. And I hope so. Next week, Fuzz will be back with us. God willing, all three of us will be back in studio live, taking your calls and questions about science and the Bible, as well as discussing the scientific discoveries of the week and how they provide powerful new evidence for the God of the Bible. And in the meantime, remember, the more we know about science, the more we have reasons to believe.
This has been a presentation of the Ministry of Reasons to Believe. If you would like to know more about other resources offered by Reasons to Believe, or have questions about issues related to science and the Christian faith, please visit our website at reasons.org or call us toll-free at 800-482-7836.